Hi there, I'm Dr. Mirdalis Diaz-Ramirez, and this is the Design Your Physician Life podcast. Welcome to this episode brought to you by our Maxillary Mastermind, an exclusive mastermind for physician entrepreneurs. Today, we have a very special guest, Dr. Corey Fawcett from Financial Success MD. We had a great conversation with Dr. Fawcett about designing an easy-to-run real estate portfolio, and we also have a special bonus for you. Are you ready? Let's go!
Welcome to the Design Your Physician Life podcast, where you will get excited about being a physician, learn the tools that can help boost your success, and great tips from successful doctors. Join us to unlock the keys to an amazing physician life. And now, here's your host, Dr. Mirdalis Diaz-Ramirez.
Hi, guys. Welcome to your Design Your Physician Life podcast. I'm super excited today to have Dr. Corey Fawcett here. He's actually a very well-known physician in our United States physician community and beyond. He's the creator of the Financial Success MD. He's also a widely known author. He has many books like The Doctor's Guide to Navigating a Financial Crisis, The Doctor's Guide to Starting Your Practice, Eliminating Debt, Smart Career Alternatives, and Retirement. And today we're going to be talking to him about real estate investing for busy professionals. Yes, that's the book that we're going to be talking about today. However, he does have an upcoming book that is going to be a bonus for the end of our conversation. So thank you for coming here today. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me come today. I always like coming and talking to you.
So, Corey, you've already talked to us about how to design your locum tenens life. Today, we want to talk about how to design your real estate portfolio and make it easy for the busy professionals. Because as we hear many say, you know, I don't want to be the one in the middle of the night fixing that toilet. So how do we make it easy for the physicians, busy professionals?
So when I grew up as a little kid, my grandparents owned rentals. They owned house rentals. I was the oldest grandson, and I got to go with grandpa and help him whenever he was fixing something. So they did everything about that. They fixed everything. They were kind of a jack of all trades, and he had a full-time job, but grandma didn't work. But I got to go and see what happened. My grandfather died young, and my grandmother was very young when he left her. But what I noticed was my grandmother did not have to go to work. My grandmother had an income coming in on the, it was about 10 houses that they owned free and clear. And because of that income, she never had to work the rest of her life. She was able to live off of that. And later on, she got to add also Social Security into her income. But, you know, I saw this with my own eyes and said, you know, that's what I want someday. I want to be able to know that if I died, my wife was just taken care of for the rest of her life. Or if for some reason I couldn't work or didn't want to work anymore, I didn't have to worry about that. I wanted what grandma had. And it's funny thing. Every other member of the family, and she had a pretty big family. She was one of 13 kids. Everyone in the family saw this take place as well. And I am the only one who went on to develop a real estate business like she did. Everybody else said exactly what you said. I don't want to fix no toilets on Thanksgiving. I don't want to do this. And you know, all those people worked until they couldn't work anymore. My grandmother was traveling around and enjoying life. And the difference was she had cash flowing real estate, and it took care of her as she aged.
So I'm pretty sure you're not spending your Thanksgivings or their Thanksgiving taking care of toilets, right? I know that would not be possible for you right now. Anyways, how old were you when you started fixing these houses with your family?
When my grandfather passed away, I think I was 15. So I was pretty young, you know, 10 to 15 years old. My grandfather got sick. He had prostate cancer and it had gone to the bones, and he lived a long time with it, but he didn't have a lot of stamina, and things made him hurt when he would do them. So I was the oldest grandson. He would bring me along and I'd do the heavy lifting. So in that age group, and then later on with my grandmother, the same thing continued. But I learned how to roof a house. I learned how to change plumbing. I learned how to fix electrical problems. I learned how to put on a new porch or put in a new floor in the bathroom. I learned all of these things working with my grandfather at first, and when he passed away, helping my grandmother do hers. So that by the time I was a physician, I already had lots of skills to take care of things around my house. And I decided, you know, I could use these skills also. But the thing is I had those skills, but if you set your real estate up right, you should never need to use those skills. I had 64 rental units while I was the manager, and I was the manager of that as a full-time general surgeon. So you got to imagine I didn't have to put very much time into that because I was pretty busy running my surgical practice. And that's how the book ended up coming about. So many people asked me, how could you do that? How could it be possible to be a full-time general surgeon and manage 64 rental units? So I answered that question so many times. I said, I just got to put this in a book. Everybody wants to know how to do this. So how does a busy professional get into this when all of them think it takes too much time? When the reality is it does not.
So some of our listeners might say, oh, you know, maybe it doesn't take much time, but it might really take a lot of my money. How do we get to the different financing alternatives? Did you get like all your properties at the same time? How have you thought about this or discussed this with other physicians about money strategies? Because there's so many different ways. I would like to see how we can make it easy first in terms of financial avenues, and then we can get to the rest of the work.
So when it came time for me to start, I had been in practice for about 6 years or 8 years. I think I was in practice for 8 years by this time. And before that we had decided we were going to get out of debt. And so we had been paying off our debts. And as we came down to the final debt, we realized that when we pay this off, what are we going to do with all this money that we have left over that we used to be paying debts with? And we decided now's the time for us to start a real estate investing. And that was back in 2001. And so I started reading about real estate and, okay, let's do this. Let me brush up on stuff a bit because I didn't really know the mechanics of how to make it happen because my grandma did all that. I just helped her with the maintenance. And so I was learning how do you buy it and such. And I read this course on no money down real estate deals, how to buy real estate with no money down. And I thought, well, that sounds like a really cool idea. And so about a month after I read that book, I was in escrow with $1 million plus piece of property with no money down, cash back at closing. And while I was in escrow, I read another book because I'm still reading, you know, trying to learn things about the real estate business. And I read this other book that says, oh yeah, I don't believe any of that stuff you read about no money down because it doesn't work. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm glad I didn't read your book first because now I've got this $1 million piece of property it was a 31 unit apartment complex. And it's in escrow right now as a no money down deal. So you don't even need money to buy real estate. It's possible because real estate is an item that you can get with leverage. You borrow money to buy it. Most people only know about conventional financing, where you might borrow 70% of the money and then you have to put in 30%. That's what almost everybody, you walk down the street, ask people, how do you finance a real estate deal? 99% of them are going to say conventional finance. That's how you do it. You put 30% down, and it takes a lot of money to buy a piece of property like that. The thing is that's only one way to buy a piece of property. There's lots of ways because you're going to borrow money anyway. It is possible to borrow 100% of the property. So the thing that I learned as I went along is that the most important part of the deal is that the property has a positive cash flow to me. So once I buy it, it puts money in my pocket every month. If it doesn't do that, that was kind of a dumb investment, right? If you buy an investment and you have to put money into it every month, that's a dumb idea.
Yeah, that's certainly a misconception that many people have. I've had it for the longest time until, you know, not too long ago. But yeah, it's not an asset. It's a liability.
It's like your own house. you got to stick money in that thing every month to own that thing. You want the property to actually pay you money every month. So the key is that you need enough down payment into the property to turn it into a positive cash flow, whatever that is, whether it's a 0% down, a 10% down, a 20%, 30%, or 50%. You just need to come up with the right scenario that actually puts this property into your portfolio and creates cash flow coming to you. And so I bought that first piece, and it turns out buying with no money down was kind of a fun thing. Basically, what it came to is I financed the 70%, and then I borrowed the other 30% and then paid that part down quickly over the next period of time with that extra money that I had coming in that used to be debt payments. So I would get rid of that right away, and I'm just left with the main mortgage. So it's basically borrowing the down payment and getting rid of it over the next couple of years is what that process was. But to me, it turned into a game. I thought, wow, if I can buy this stuff with no money down, why don't I do that again? It was kind of cool. And I set out to only buy properties with no money down. Now, that's certainly not needed, but it just became a game to me. I thought this would be fun if I can pinpoint. So I taught a realtor what I wanted, and I sent him out to get it for me. There's no point in you. You're a busy professional. One of the things you want to save time on is hunting down real estate deals. You don't have time to be hunting down real estate deals. And the realtor who's going to sell it is going to make a pretty penny off of that deal anyway. Make him earn the money. Tell him what you want exactly. Make them go find it, and they call you.
So when looking for that type of property, what would you specifically tell your realtor or broker, the things that are you looking for, the things that you really want for them when they're bringing you a property?
So I was out to conquer no money down deals, and I loved owner financing. It's easier, cheaper, and way more flexible. So that was just two aspects I like. So I told him that I wanted to buy a property that he figured out would be a positive cash flow if it was 100% financed, and that there's a possibility that the owner could carry the loan. Now, it doesn't have to say on the thing that for sale that owner will carry. All that has to be is that the owner has almost no mortgage left on it or doesn't have a mortgage, because that's a potential owner could carry the loan. So I wanted that. I wanted it to be within 20 minutes of my house. I did not want a fixer-upper. I don't have time for fixing up stuff. I need a place that the prior owner took care of. So it's up to date. Everything's okay. And I didn't really care what the price was, because if I'm going to buy it with no money down, it doesn't really matter how much it costs, because it's not going to come out of my pocket.
So like, what would be like the minimum door number? How many doors you think that you'd recommend to buy?
I did not when I started. After I've done it for a while, yes. Now that I know better, I would say I don't want to buy less than eight unit apartments. I bought small apartment complexes, and I have one fourplex. And I found that the fourplex just doesn't make as good a money as the other ones. The fewer doors you have, the higher the price per door is. But the rent is about the same. So you're paying more money for it, but you're going to collect the same rent. So for me, if you buy, say you buy a single family house in your area costs $800,000. Maybe a duplex. Now, two places might cost you $900,000 because you're getting two of them, but they're $450,000 a piece. But an eightplex, they might cost $350,000 per door. Or a tenplex might cost $250,000 per door. So when you buy more units in one, now you have one roof, one electricity bill, one garbage bill. Everything is in the same place. It just becomes more effective. And when somebody moves out, only one out of eight people are not paying rent, versus if you just buy a house, and they move out, you're 100% vacant. And so if I knew what I knew later, I would have never bought the fourplex. I would have stuck with 8 units or better, just because of the economies of scale get better. But as you get bigger and bigger and bigger, they get maybe prohibitively expensive for you. And because you might not be doing a no money down deal and you need to come up with some down payment money. And so there could be a limit to how much you could do that way. But at no money down, I could do anything. And my son was a teenager at the time. He said, well, Dad, if you can buy it, and he saw it happen, if you can buy a property with no money, I got no money. That means I could buy a property. And he was out hunting for properties. Today he owns three houses free and clear. Rentals. He's 30.
And he's only 30, you know, and efficient and just starting there on that real estate, right?
Yeah. And he bought his first property with no money down. And so just a few years ago. And of course, every single year, people tell me, oh, yeah, that no money down thing, that used to work, but it doesn't work anymore. I mean, the year I bought it, I read a book that says that doesn't work. And then every year since then, when I tell somebody, oh, yeah, you could buy it with no money down, they say, oh, that used to be that way, but you can't do it anymore. They've been saying that forever. It's never changed. It's always been available and it always will be.
Talking about different points of view, right? When people are telling you, you cannot do this, you cannot do that. Did you have your family on your side when you started, when you were looking for that property? Did you have your friends on your side? Did you tell anybody about the plans of buying this property, like $1 million property with no money down?
I did not tell anybody about that, no. My wife knew, and we had decided that we were going to go into real estate investing. It wasn't something she was excited about. That's not her thing. She was willing to help me and she was willing to participate and go into it. So we wouldn't have done it if she'd have said no, because we would only do major things that both of us would agree on. And so we were really the only two that knew about it. My parents and family and such, they knew about it after the fact. In fact, one family member was even part of the loan for the down payment. And so everybody did well. In fact, as time went by and people saw the success I had generated, later on, I had family members actually coming to me asking, could they put money into one of my deals? Because they saw other people making money off of what I was doing. Because I learned later on that I didn't even need a bank to do this deal. It happened again with my grandmother. I learned this lesson with my grandmother. She had a house, have a big major accident at the house, and the house was condemned. And then they tore the house down and rebuilt it. Okay. She didn't want to rent out that beautiful brand new house. She decided she was going to sell it. So she was going to sell one of her properties, and this one was at a handsome profit. And this was right around 2008, in that time era. And she, interest rates were super low. You know, you could get nothing for her money in the bank. She couldn't get a certificate of deposit. And so she came to me and says, I've got all this money. I need to invest it someplace. Where can I put it? And I went looking for her and I couldn't find a good place for her to put the money where it would just be safe. And then I realized, no, wait a minute. I was just about to refinance a deal and I was going to be paying 5% interest on the loan. I'm paying the bank 5% interest to do this deal. And the bank is turning around and giving my grandmother less than 1% on the money they're loaning to make the deal. She loans them the money. They give her a little bit of interest. They loan the money to me and make a lot of interest. And I thought, how could I cut the bank out and let grandma have the 5%? So if I have to pay 5% anyway, why don't I pay it to her? And she didn't have enough money for me to make this deal. So I decided this could be really good. And I asked other relatives, and this is now I have several years of real estate under my belt and they see the success. And I had several people take me up on this, and I collected enough money to not need the bank for the refinance. I refinanced with family members and I gave them all the 5% with money that they had been making less than 1% on. And so with the stroke of a pen, I transferred $25,000 a year from the bank to my family. And it was no change for me. I paid the same interest I was going to pay, but I cut the bank out of the deal. And my whole family, and in the beginning, there were family members that said, I want to do this. And they said, I don't get involved with investing with family. Okay, that's fine. Lots of people feel that way, and that's okay. I just need the ones who want to. So I did a couple of deals. And then later on, I never went back to that person because I knew they didn't do this stuff. Later on, they came to me and says, how come you didn't offer me that last deal you made? I said, well, but you told me you didn't want to do deals with family. Well, I do now. She had watched the other family members do this and make the money, never missed a payment. Everything was fine. They got a lot more interest than she's been getting. And she changed her mind and said, I want a part of that too. And so I was able to not only use my real estate business to create security for me and my wife, for the rest of our life, but I added some security and extra income to a lot of my extended family members in the process. And that was a true win-win for our family. And I really loved doing that. That was really fun.
That's really fun. You became a hero, you know, for your family.
Yeah. They were coming to me with money. Are you going to make another deal? Cause I got some money I'd like to put into it. And we just used them for the financing there after a while. And it turned out really nice. So there are really some creative ways that a person, when you're going to buy an investment property, you're going to use some leverage. You're going to use some sort of loan on the property because almost no one buys their first investment properties with all cash because they don't have it. If you were already rich enough to do that, you wouldn't need to be investing in stuff, right? You'd already be there. So if you're going to borrow the money anyway, there's more than one way to do that.
So let's talk about Dr. Corey Fawcett, the surgeon who just purchased 31 doors at no money down, no cash down. How did you show up to work after you had those 31 doors? Did that change your performance? How did it change your performance? Or, you know, what was the difference for you after that?
Okay. Nothing. Nothing changed. This was always a plan. At some point, I was going to get into real estate. I didn't know what it was. To me, this was just another investment. I have my 401k and it's just invested in stuff. And the real estate is just a different investment. And so it didn't really change anything for me at that point. What it did change is my wife and I made a decision that we wanted to take the next 12 months to learn about real estate. And so we decided that for the first 12 months of ownership of that 31 units, we were going to do everything that needed to be done. Everything. We did the yard work. We did, if somebody moved out, we repainted the place. I used all those skills I learned from my grandparents on taking care of it. And for 1 year, we just said, we're going to do this. Now, I'm a full-time general surgeon. My wife doesn't work. She never went over there and did stuff without me. We only did it together. So it can fit into that schedule to do that with 31 units. But after 1 year, now we fully understood exactly what it takes to run this place. We began to automate everything after that. We started out by hiring a gardener. He's going to take care of the grounds. We don't have to do that anymore. Then we hired a manager. He's going to take care of all the repair works. We don't have to do that anymore, you know. And so we began to automate everything. And so pretty soon, I had bought more units. And now I had 64 rental units. And I was taking care of them on less than 10 hours a month. Now, I spend more than 10 hours a month going to church on Sundays. I spent less than that managing the manager. I'm the manager still. I'm managing 64 units, and it takes less than that to do it. And I could have done it on even less than that, but there were a few things I liked doing. It was a real change of pace. Some doctors want to come home and garden. for me, it was kind of fun to go home and go fix something someplace. I'm a surgeon. I'm a fix-it guy. So it was fun for me and a change of pace. So I kept a few little things that I would do that I could have farmed out just as a change of pace for me. So what changed at the office for me is I owned the office building with a group of guys. They kind of saw what I was doing out there. Man, this guy runs all that apartments. He should be running our office building. I became the guy who took care of our office building. So in our office, we divided up the work. Each person was in charge of a particular piece of that business. And so they put me in charge of the building. You're the guy. You take care of this place. So that's really the only thing that changed for me at work, because we just fit the thing right into a normal schedule. And once everything was automated, gosh, it takes, you know, now I probably spend as much time on my real estate, and I still have 55 units, as I do on my 401k. They're about the same amount of effort at this point. And so if you can imagine how much time you spend taking care of your 401k, that's how much I spend roughly doing my real estate. I just got back from a 4, 5, 6 week vacation. We went to to explore around Lake Michigan. That was today's blog as we record this, was that trip. 6 weeks I was gone over there. And during that time, 2 months worth of income came rolling right into my bank while I was gone.
When was when you realized that, you know, I can be sick, I can be absent, I can be away if I want to, I just don't have to work? When did you become financially free?
I was age 50. It was 12 years roughly after I bought my first one. Okay. I had 65 rental units at the time. And every year the profits had gone up and gone up. Rents go up. I'm paying off some mortgages. So profits are climbing every year. And at that, there was a point where I was now making more money from my real estate than I was spending in my life. My expenses were exceeded by my real estate income. That didn't count the fact that I still had a 401k and my IRA and my wife's IRA and a deferred comp account. I mean, I still had the usual retirement stuff.
And a surgeon's job, right?
And I'm still a surgeon. All of those things are happening. And I realized that the real estate actually brings in more money than I spend all by itself. And so I decided at that point, and I had always planned to retire from medicine at age 50. This now I'm 50 and I can do it. But I wasn't ready to give up medicine. I enjoyed medicine, but what I would have liked to do is work a little less hard. And so I started cutting back on my practice, and I didn't see as many patients. I spent more time on each patient. I did a little less. I kind of cut down to about close to half time working. And then it got to where my wife was saying, you know, if you cut down any more, you're going to be paying your partners for the privilege of working, because my expenses at work were fixed. And so if I brought down what my production was, pretty soon my production fell below my fixed expenses at work. And so I talked to them about that, and there was no option for me being part-time in our practice. They want full-time people, and so they weren't going to work that out. And so I decided I needed to retire from my practice. And that's when I began doing the locum tenens. And I did that for 3 years, half time. I'd work 2 weeks a month as a locums doctor, helping out doctors at critical access hospitals that only had one surgeon and he needed some breaks. And so that was very light work. I mean, I only did one patient a day on average, one new patient a day. And I got full-time pay while I was doing that, because I'm covering for him. That was a pretty good 3 years. And then at the end of those 3 years, I began getting some other interests, like my Financial Success MD stuff and all of the books that I was writing. And when those started to take off, I thought, you know, I should probably just get rid of the medicine stuff and do this other stuff now. And it's time for me to go into the next phase of my life and teach people about these things and travel. I really wanted to travel. And so I dropped all of that stuff. And my original plan was when I retired, I would do more of the work, not less, because I wanted to be like my grandpa. And that's what he did with his time, was he fixed stuff at the places. And I thought that's what I would do. But I wanted to travel. And those two didn't go together. I couldn't be here taking care of all the property and traveling in Europe. And so rather than do more, I actually went to doing even less. And I hired a full-time people to take care of the property. And then I did nothing. So now I'm down to close to nothing. And I was traveling all over the world. Before COVID, we were gone 56% of the year on some adventure someplace. And my real estate was paying the bills.
So, Corey, we've talked about how to make it easy to get the property, you know, all the things that you've also talked about, having somebody else take care of it. In your case, it was an exception because you needed exactly what had to be done. And we have many physicians who are still looking, you know, they will know that there's some advantages. You've told us about paying for all this stuff and having all these investments. But let's talk about that to that person who's really not convinced about real estate. Two things. One, it's, you know, how to acquire the passion about real estate? How does it really allow you to travel and all this stuff from a financial point of view? Substituting, how does it shelter your salary? Can you explain a little bit more about that as a physician? And the other part would be, how can I get the property now? Because you were taking care of this property on your own for 1 year, but I might not want to do that. And I don't know maybe really as a physician how to build a team. So we want those two things. One is about that passion and the sheltering of our salaries, those advantages. And the other one is like, I really don't want to do all those things for a year because I really don't have the time. I don't want to do it. How do we build those teams?
If you knew absolutely nothing about real estate, this is what you do. You make sure that the piece of property you're going to buy will have a positive cash flow. And there's a whole chapter in my book on how to do the cash flow and make sure that it's positive. You make sure that you have a positive cash flow. And then the day you buy it, you hand it to a property management company and say, you guys take care of this thing for me. And you're done. You can go do whatever you want to do. You won't be part of any of the taking care of that real estate. All your job will be is to cash the checks. Occasionally, they're going to have a limit as to what they're allowed to do. And you can set that limit. Let's say the limit is $500. If something happened that costs more than $500 to do it, they have to call you and get permission. And so I'm traveling all over the world, right? So I told them, you don't call me for nothing. You send me an email. If you need my permission, just send me an email. And I always tell them, yes. Just, okay, yeah, fix it. But then initially, I was getting too many of those calls. And so I just went to them and says, just raise that number. You don't call me unless it's $1,000. You know, bother me less. You take care of it. I am paying for you to take care of this stuff. You do it. Quit calling me. And so they actually got a new person who, while I was traveling in Michigan, she actually called me on the phone. She's a new person at the property management company. She calls me on the phone and she says, hey, I just want to let you know, we're going to have to repaint this one unit. I said, oh, really? And why did you call me? And she says, well, I wanted to get to know you. And I always call my owners. And I says, well, and then I explained to the new girl, I don't want you to ever call me. If I'm out, you know, canoeing down a river, I don't want to get a call from you. You send me an email and I will respond when I can. I'm trying to make my life better. And it's your job to make my life better. And if you call me about things like that, you're not making my life better. I'm having to stop at whatever I'm doing and answer the phone and talk to you about this. You need me to okay a paint job. Why didn't you just send me an email that says we're going to paint the place. It's going to cost $1,500. Is that okay? And I just type okay. And I'm done. And they get used to what you want and what you're going to okay and what you might say no to. And then sometimes when I'm in town, they'll tell me something. It just happened this last week. And they said, you know, hey, we need to replace the carpet. We need to repaint the whole place, this and that. And I said, great. Today's a really good time for me. I'm home. I got nothing to do today. I'm going to swing by and inspect that unit myself. And they actually went and re-inspected it before I got there. And they came back and said, well, I don't think we have to repaint it. And I, you know, and I went in and re-inspected it. And then I said, you know, yes, you can replace the carpet. No, we're not repainting this place. So periodically I would go in
to get random testing, you know, you're like, just like random. It happens like random apartment inspecting. And so you
these are your investments. You should keep a little bit of a tab on them. You should go check. I'll give you a story of why this is important. The first place that I bought the 31 units, I couldn't believe the guy was selling them. These things are making you lots of money. He's got no loan on them. They're just cash pouring in. Why is this guy selling them? And so I asked him that question. Why are you selling this? And he said, well, I hired my friend to take care of it because he wants to sail around the world. And so I was sailing around the world and my friend was taking care of it. Well, if he's on the other end of the world, he's definitely not checking in on his friend, right? And so he called one day to talk to a tenant and said, hey, how are things going around there? And she says, oh, is this Scott? Yeah, this is Scott. I thought you were dead. What do you mean you thought I was dead? He says, well, your friend, the manager here, he said you died someplace out on a boat thing out in the middle of the ocean and no one found your body and he's got the place up for sale. And so you can imagine this guy parked his boat, flew home, got rid of that guy, and then he put the place up for sale. Because now he didn't want to actually have to check on these guys at all. He wanted to be sailing around the world and cashing checks. So I offered him to buy the place. You finance the thing, and every month I will put a deposit right into your account. And so wherever you are in the world, you can just go to an ATM machine and get the money you need to keep your sailing going. And you don't have to worry about anything because I'm taking care of everything. All you have to worry about is that I actually put the check in every month. And so he liked that way better. So if you don't know anything, there are professionals who just do real estate management. You know, just hire a property manager, hand them the keys, let them take care of it. You don't have to learn anything. If you want to, you can then learn from them and watch what they're doing and learn how things work. So you don't need the knowledge to fix all those things. There are people to do that. And so frankly, now, you shouldn't be. You're a doctor.
So, you know, you've told us to buy something. You've told us how to manage that property. But why would she still do it? You know, like, it's really enough for us to go around and travel the world. What are the advantages of that real estate investment?
The most important advantage is what I talked about earlier is having the cash flow. Okay. So this is what the government calls passive income. You don't have to do anything. It's passive and you make money. Okay. So as a physician, if I didn't show up to do your gallbladder surgery, I don't get paid. I don't show up. I don't get paid. If I get hurt and can't work anymore, I don't get paid. My friend here in town had a stroke, wiped out his career in one day. He don't get paid. But with real estate, once you own the property, the cash flow belongs to you for the rest of your life. The cash flow just keeps coming in. Whether you like it or not, the money keeps getting deposited into your account. So even if you can't work or you get disabled or you have a stroke or something happens, or your parents get sick and you have to stay with them and help them, the money keeps coming in. And the thing that's good about that money is it's not fixed. It's not a fixed income. Right now we have inflation. Prices are going up. But guess what that means? That means rent is going up. So one of the things that determine the inflation rate is the current rent rate. That means your rent goes right up with inflation. So as you own this stuff, as time goes by, you make more and more money each year. Debts get paid off, rents go up, your cash flow goes up. So when you own this, not only do you not have to work for the money, the money you get every month begins to climb and continues to climb for the rest of your life. So you get this great automatic growth. Now, on top of that growth, much of it is tax-free. Because of depreciation, the first, I think it was about 8 years I was investing in property, I paid zero taxes on any of the income that came in off the property. Because I had an amount of depreciation that was available every year. In the beginning, I wasn't quite earning as much as my depreciation was. And so all of it was tax-free. And the gap was saved for next year. And so every year, as my income got up and the depreciation is fixed, the income pretty soon passed the depreciation. And then for a while, I'm using up the depreciation I didn't use the years before. And pretty soon that finally caught up. So it took 8 or so years before I owed a dollar of tax on any of the money I'd made from the real estate. And the way it's working today, as that continued to grow, approximately half of the money that I make in real estate is not taxable because of the depreciation. And the rest of the money is taxed as passive income, which is a lower tax cost to me than earned income. If you work as a physician, you pay the highest amount that you can pay in taxes. That's the highest taxed event. Real estate is lower taxed. And so with passive income, I don't pay taxes as much. I don't pay any payroll taxes, for example, which if you're self-employed, that's 15% of what came in that you don't have to pay. And so there's some cool tax advantages. Now, I bought the real estate only for the cash flow, but we all know that real estate values go up in time. And so the property appreciates. So it's worth a whole lot more today than it was when I first bought it. But I can't spend any of that money. So I don't really count on any of that. That'll be something that my kids are going to get someday when I die. Now, all that profit that I would have made, and if I sold it, I'd have to pay some capital gains taxes. No, they reset the value of the property to what they inherited it as. And so that capital gains never gets taxed. So there's some great tax advantages that you do not get as a physician that you can get in real estate. And so all of these things put together make real estate so much better and more powerful as an income source than your earned income as a physician, which is just limited to how much time you can put in. I could only work 24 hours a day, and then I don't know how long I could keep that up. But with real estate, you can always own more.
More than a day and a half or two working and?
As I got older, it became harder and harder for me to recover from an all-nighter of working.
That's definitely not a worthy challenge. I do have another question. We taught everybody how good it is to have real estate, how easy it is to make it easy for the busy professionals like physicians like us. But I want to talk about our special bonus because we have only like 10 minutes left and I want to make sure that we focus on your next adventure, which apparently is gonna generate a lot of comments. Because your new book coming August 30th, 2022, and we want to introduce you, is your guide to loving your timeshare.
Right. I mean, most of the financial people out there just spout the same old stuff over and over about how terrible a timeshare is. And that has never been my experience. I own a timeshare. And our family has loved it. It has been a great thing. And I keep hearing all these people say these terrible things about timeshares. And everything they tell me, I say, well, but that's not true. And then they would say something else, but that's not true. And I realized there's nobody out there telling the other side of the story that timeshares really are a good thing and you can do really well. And what I discovered was as I paid closer attention, that most people are just regurgitating what they heard somebody else say. And it was a lot like the reluctant landlord in real estate. The reluctant landlord is a guy who owns a house and can't sell it and has to move. And so he decides to rent it. And he didn't want to be a landlord, but now he is a landlord. And that house wasn't bought as a rental, but it is one. And it never quite turns out right. And then he runs around telling everybody how rental property stinks. It's terrible. I mean, you know, but he isn't somebody who should be teaching you what. He's a reluctant landlord. He never wanted to be this. He didn't buy this to make money. And yet he's around telling you what it's like. And that's not what you want. So there's, for example, if you ever hear somebody telling you the bad things about timeshares and they say a comment like this, and these guys are easy to tell, they don't know what they're talking about. If they say something like, well, you don't want to be stuck going to the same place every year. If you hear somebody say that, you know, that person doesn't know what they're actually talking about timeshares. They're just regurgitating stuff they've heard. Because I've been in timeshare owner for around 30 years. I have never gone to the timeshare I own. I've never been there. I've never stayed there. There are 4,000 other places I can go now that I'm in the club of owning a timeshare and I can trade it around with other timeshares. If somebody ever tells you something like that, that, oh, you don't want to be stuck going to the same place all the time, you know that they don't even realize that, wait a minute, you can trade this for 4,000 other places. And most of the people who actually own a timeshare don't know they can trade their timeshare for something else because there's nobody teaching them. So one of the things I wanted to do with my book was teach people who are the right people to buy a timeshare, because there are definitely some criteria. If you don't meet these criteria, you won't be a happy, even if you got your timeshare for free. If you don't meet these criteria, you're going to be like the 45-year-old with three kids who traded in his minivan because he really liked Corvettes. And he bought a Corvette. And about 6 months later, he's really unhappy because he can only put one kid in the car at a time. And now he's blaming the Corvette. It's not the Corvette's fault. You bought something you shouldn't have owned. He shouldn't have owned that as his only car. He could own that as an additional car, but he needed the van. You know, he didn't qualify to own a Corvette. And so if I want to teach people who qualifies, and if you qualify, you'll be a happy timeshare owner. And then secondly, how to use your timeshare effectively so that you know how to trade it. I own 1 week a year and I go to approximately 7 weeks of vacations without paying for them every year. Now, most people don't know you can do that either. And so my actual cost per week, including, and I bought it at retail. I didn't know better when I got there. I want to teach you how to buy it cheap, but I bought it expensive. I bought it at full retail. I've owned it for 30 years. I've paid those dues, the maintenance fees every year for 40 years. I've done all the trading fees. My average cost per week of vacation at a five-star place is $640. That's about what it would have cost to stay at a Motel 6 in the same town. And I can stay at a five-star resort for $640 a week. Now, I just went on 4 weeks of back-to-back timeshares up in the Lake Michigan area. I just got back from there. And those 4 weeks cost me around $2,400 to have those 4 weeks. It's about $640 a week. I stayed in a motel for 5 days at the beginning of that because I wanted to hang out in downtown Chicago, right in the loop where everything is. I wanted to be there for 5 days before I started on this stuff. Those 5 days cost me $1,500. 5 days for $1,500 at a place that was just a bedroom and a bathroom versus $2,400 for 4 weeks. And the biggest one I had was 3 bedrooms, 2 baths. And all the amenities that came with it. And so there's really no comparison. Timeshares are cheaper and everybody seems to try and make you think they're expensive. But most of the people that are downgrading timeshares had a bad experience because nobody taught them how to do it. And they're just like the reluctant landlords. They think it's a terrible thing because it happened terrible to them. But if they'd have learned about real estate, the reluctant landlord would be making money instead of griping about their real estate. And there was one chapter at the end of the books that I went around at the pool for, it was 3 weeks back-to-back timeshares, and I interviewed people about their timeshare. Tell me what you'd want people to know. And at the end of every interview, I ask them, do you think you got good value for your money? Every single person said yes. I couldn't find a single person who said, no, this is too expensive. And yet that is all I hear on the internet, that they're so expensive. And yet all these people around the pool, the problem is the people who know how to use it are there at the pool. The people who don't know how to use it are back home griping about it because they can't seem to make a trade, and they don't even know they can make a trade. They can't get that they want. They keep paying this thing. They only have 2 weeks of vacation a year, and they don't have time to use their timeshare. I.e., they should have never bought one. They don't have enough vacation time for this. And they're home griping. But the thing is, the people who know what they're doing, man, we're loving it. And I just wanted to get that message out to people. So August 30th, it comes out available on Amazon, A Guide to Loving Your Timeshare.
Well, guys, you've heard it here from Dr. Corey Fawcett. You can design your physician life as a real estate investor, and you can also have a wonderful life as a timeshare owner, especially when we combine both, you know, having your passive income and then having all the time to go and enjoy your timeshare. So thank you. Thank you very much for being here. It's like always, you know, buckloads of information from you, tons of tips for our listeners. And we're looking forward for when you have time again to talk about us. How it went with this book is just going to be so exciting.
Yeah, I'm just I'm planning for the barrage of bad email of all those people that think. I mean, there are people who tell you, you know, you make a deal with the devil when you buy a timeshare. But if that's true, I've got a pretty good deal, because we've had a great time in the 30 years we've been using ours.
Congratulations on your new book. We look forward to hear more about it. And thanks a lot for being here.
Hey, thank you. And check me out at financialsuccessmd.com. And there's a lot of other information too.
Any other ways you want people to find you?
That's the easy way. Start there. I'm on Twitter and Pinterest and Facebook. But if you start there, you can get to all those other places as well.
There you go. Financial Success MD. See you guys. Have a great day.
Thanks for having me.
And now, guys, I'm going to give you a bonus. After we finished our conversation with Dr. Fawcett, he continued talking to me about timeshare, and we didn't stop the recording. So here's this bonus for you.
Usually when I sit down and talk to somebody, they hear stuff they didn't realize. I didn't know that. How can you own 1 week and go on 7 vacations?
Because you have, as I understand, tell me if I'm wrong, you're the owner of the timeshare still. And I've tried to own one of it. I just didn't have the time to take off to be able to really take advantage of it. You purchase like this amount of weeks and then those days and a certain number for then during the year you can go and they have points that are at a much lower price. And then you can get so many extra days because of alternating those points, correct?
For example, I own 75 points or something like that. So 65, somewhere up in that number. But my average trade is around 10 points. So, and you can get a trade as low as 3 points. So it depends on, some of the places are basically on sale, just like the airplanes do and the cruise ships do. They have sales. And if a place is building a timeshare, they want people there to try and sell them timeshares. They'll make their timeshare cheaper to get into and easier. And so go to that one, but don't go to their meeting. Just go to their timeshare and you can get it for cheaper. And now you can trade. So if I have 65 points and I just traded one for 12. Now I've got, you know, 53 points left and I can make another trade. But if I just used my own place, then I used all the 65 points for 1 day, one week. If I stay at my own place, that's the most expensive way to use your timeshare. And I met somebody at one of the pools when I was interviewing them, and she owns a timeshare and she does the same as me. She's never been to her own timeshare because that's the expensive way to use it. And she had stayed at my timeshare. And I have never stayed at my timeshare. But I had stayed at her timeshare. And so we had each stayed at each other's timeshare before and yet never been at our own. And we were both doing this same same thing. And so she bought a place in Hawaii. And when I went to Hawaii on this one island, I stayed at the timeshare she owns. And so.
Yeah, here's really at the end where, you know, it's so big and so small at the same time.
It is. There is so much cool stuff. This last vacation, you should read my blog that came out today. The last vacation, we went not knowing what was there. We knew that wherever they have timeshares, they only put them where lots of people want to come because they need a lot of traffic coming through there. So there's something there. And so we just booked four timeshares in the area and we went and just when we got there, we figured out what is there to do around here and we did it. And so we found all kinds of cool stuff to do. We didn't plan this trip ahead of time. We just knew that if there's a timeshare there, something draws people to that area and we're going to find out what it is. And now we're just exploring to new places we've never been before. Okay, there's a cool place to trade. Let's go there. I don't know what's there. Let's find out. But you got to have enough vacation time to do that. If you only have 2 weeks of vacation a year, you got no business buying a timeshare. Because you're going to need that vacation to go visit your mother and you're going to go to the high school reunion and you're going to take a couple of sick days that you used your vacation for. And now when are you going to go on your cruise that you want to go on? When are you going to go use your timeshare? You don't have enough vacation time to be buying a vacation ahead of time because you won't use it. And so in my book, I said, you need at least 3 weeks of vacation a year. If you don't have that, don't even consider buying a timeshare. I took 8 to 12 weeks of vacation every year during my practice. And so I had lots of room to use timeshares. You really need a lot of vacation time because there's so much vacation time you can use with one timeshare. Once you're in the system and you're allowed to trade around, you can look for bargains, you can buy stuff. You can buy extra weeks for cheap. I can, you know, it costs $600 and something for me to stay at a Motel 6 for a week. I can buy a week at a timeshare if I'm an owner for $500. And that's not even using my times. That's extra. I'm just buying an extra one. And they have extras because people trade their timeshares for things like cruises. You can exchange your timeshare for a cruise.
I have a question about timeshares, about maintenance, because maintenance fees increase every year. And I think when you're talking to people who are candidates about, when to purchase these shouldn't really be people who are on a fixed income without any extra passive income that's not going to be able to commit to the growth of these charges that are going to happen with time.
Yes, timeshares are an upscale vacation. Okay. If you are not someone who's going to take upscale vacations, you shouldn't be owning a timeshare. It's kind of like buying a Tesla. If you're going to own a Tesla, it's an upscale car. If you're not the person who drives an upscale car, you shouldn't be buying a Tesla. A timeshare is the same way. If you like to vacation at upscale places, then you'll enjoy your timeshares because they're going to cost money. This trip cost us about $15,000, but only $2,000 of it was our room. The rest was all the other stuff you do. And if you don't have the money for your whole family to get an airplane ticket to go someplace, you mentioned the maintenance fee. The maintenance fee is not the problem for that person. They don't have any problem paying the maintenance fee. They have problem buying the airplane tickets to get there. That's their problem. They don't have the money to vacation like this. It's not the maintenance fee. Maintenance fees are not that expensive. When you add my maintenance fee and my trade fee and the cost for buying the whole thing, you add them all together. Today, I'm paying $640 a week for this. And that includes the cost of buying the thing way back then. If you just looked at my maintenance fee, what if your maintenance fee was $1,000 a year? What if it was that? Maybe it was $2,000 a year. And you could use that for 7 weeks of vacation for $2,000. Is that expensive?
It's certainly not expensive, no.
No. But do you have $2,000 to go on vacations this year? If you don't, you shouldn't have been buying a timeshare. You don't qualify. When you go to timeshare places, the qualifications that they use is you're over 25, married, and make at least $50,000 a year. None of those are the qualifications I said in my book. Those don't matter. The qualifications are more like you have at least 3 weeks of vacation. You like to do upscale vacations. You have enough money to pay for upscale vacations and airplane tickets for everybody who's going, and the rental car you're going to use when you go there. You know, it's these other factors, and they never talk about those at their timeshare presentation. If you're a warm body and you could make the payments, we want you to buy our timeshare. And that's why there's so many unhappy timeshares. It's the salesmen that sell them to people who should have never purchased that.
Oh, geez, yes. Attraction tickets are so expensive.
That's how I got my timeshare. I was in New Orleans at a meeting. My wife was there, and it was like our fifth anniversary or something. It was an anniversary for us. And I saw this, it was in New Orleans, and I saw this free buggy, horse-drawn buggy ride around the thing. But those were $25. And I was a resident. I didn't have $25 to pay for a buggy ride, but I could get a free one if I go listen to the spiel. And I went and listened to it. I ended up buying a timeshare. And that $25 buggy ride is the most expensive buggy ride I've ever been on. And I got sucked into that, and I should not have purchased a timeshare at that moment. I did not qualify at that moment. I was a resident. I was in my final year. So next year, my wife really wanted to do it because she saw that as a way to take a workaholic and force him to go on vacation with her. And that's what she saw, a forced vacation. And we would take them because we paid for them already. And it worked out really well. But if I had stayed in the situation I was in when I bought them, I would have been a very unhappy timeshare owner because we didn't really have money to go on trips like that. If you take a family of five on a vacation to Disney World and you live on the West Coast, you're looking at thousands and thousands of dollars. It's probably going to be a $10,000 trip at least for the week. All the tickets you're going to buy, all the food you're going to eat, the car you're going to rent, the place you're going to stay, the airplane tickets, this is going to be close to $10,000. If that's not the kind of vacation you can go on, you have no business purchasing a timeshare because that's the kind of vacation they will be.
And that, guys, has been our big, huge bonus for you today, how to love your timeshare. Thank you for being here, Dr. Fawcett. You're just keep giving and giving and giving. So thanks a lot. I'm happy for you and your family that you've had such a wonderful time, not only through your real estate business, but also being able to have family time and memories with your timeshare. Because at the end, you know, that's what we want. We want for ourselves to be happy, have contribution, being able to give to others and share those experiences with our families. So thank you very much.
Well, guys, that's it for today. Stay tuned for more of our Design Your Physician Life podcast, which was brought to you today by our Maxillar Mastermind, an exclusive mastermind for physician entrepreneurs. We will continue to bring you useful resources to develop your physician entrepreneur life like we did today with Dr. Corey Fawcett. Actually, go ahead and check out his new book, How to Love Your Timeshare, and visit his website, financialsuccessmd.com. Thank you for joining us. We hope you had a great time as we did. Stay in touch with us. Visit our website, maxillar.com. That is M-A-X-A-L-L-U-R-E. Please don't forget to subscribe, like us, give us 5 stars, and share the love. Share with your friends and family. See you later. Bye.
Please remember that Design is not providing specific financial, medical, or career advice. Our only intent is to stimulate your appetite for growth by sharing our experience and those of our speakers, coaches, and guests. Your personal growth and success will be unique to your circumstances and your hard work. We sincerely hope you enjoy the show and look forward to seeing you next week. We'll be right back.